this meeting of the regular meeting of the Central Mass Sanitation Agency to order. And let's do the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Yes. Mary Beth Bushy?
Present.
Michael Borstein?
Here.
Doug Kelly?
Here.
Dan Hilmer?
Here.
And Ellen Zradnick?
Here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Now we have open period for public participation, open time for public expression, up to 2 minutes per speaker on items within CMSA's jurisdiction and not on the Board of Commissioners' agenda. The board will not discuss or take action during open time, but board members may briefly respond to statements made or questions proposed by the public. Ask for clarification from staff, refer the matter to staff, or request staff to report back to the body at a subsequent meeting concerning any matter, or take action to direct staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. I don't think we have any public here, so.
I have a quick comment,
okay.
Commissioner Borstein. So I want to point out that we have a celebrity with us. She's on the cover of a CWA newsletter as an emerging professional. There's a nice article on the back. So while she's here, I wanted to point that out.
Would you sign mine?
This is great publicity.
It's great.
Very cool.
It's very awesome. Lucky.
Yeah.
No, you didn't. You're an engineer. You worked very hard.
Well, at least making the cover. I don't know how they end up choosing my picture.
Well, the inside article is very nice.
Huh?
The inside article.
Oh, yeah.
You nailed it.
Yeah. Well deserved.
You're talking about wearing different hats, but you're not wearing any hat. Three, four.
No, yeah.
I'd like to suggest that we move item number 9. With the draft license agreement with the Marin Airporter up, as Mr. Laporte from the Marin Airporter is here currently.
Should we do consent first and then that?
That sounds good. Second?
Yeah. Okay.
That sounds good. Is everybody okay with that?
All right.
Okay. So, consent calendar. Matters listed under this item are considered routine and will be enacted by one motion. Consent calendar may include resolutions. Therefore, the motion, second, and vote will also be applicable. The resolution and recorded accordingly. There will be no separate discussion of these items unless requested by a board member of the board or the public prior to the time the board votes to adopt the motion to adopt. Would anybody like to pull anything off the consent calendar?
I'll move the consent calendar.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Drum roll, please.
We just put the consent calendar, so we're ready to move on to item 9. I'm taking it
out of order. You have to stand up and do the pledge all by yourself.
So, yeah. So, item 9.
Item number 9 is the draft license agreement with Marin Airport.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Worthing. So as you recall, back at the May meeting, we discussed a proposal from the Marin Airporter to park Marin Transit District buses or corporation yard, as well as what they call non-revenue vehicles and employee vehicles in our portion of our employee parking lot. A good discussion on that, and the board said, you know, it makes sense to help out another public agency with this parking since we have a large piece of land with a good portion of it with no plans for the next, you know, several years. And you're authorizing me to work with Mr. Laporte to prepare a draft, you know, property use or lease type of agreement. So we've done that over the last couple months. We also, the first thing we did is we did, CMSA contracted with David Tattersall to prepare an appraisal of about 20,000 acres in the corporation yard, a portion being an employee parking lot, a portion being in the corporation yard. And he completed that a couple weeks ago. That was reviewed by Mr. Laporte and myself. And we thought it looked pretty good. It was reasonable. The square foot cost, which was 30 cents per square foot based on several comparators, recent comparators in the Central Marin area. In concurrent to David Perry Matt, our construction contract attorney, Bill McInerney, took a, I guess, a first draft lease agreement that Mr. Laporte prepared using the Ross Valley 2006 lease agreement as a template. He took that and he converted it into what he says is more appropriate, a license agreement for use of the property. So that's what's attached to the staff report. So Larry and I also reviewed that. You know, we each had some comments to it. I worked with Bill on my comments first, and Larry had some comments. We incorporated, I think, almost all of his. And so that's attached to the staff report also. And then lastly, I met with our ad hoc property space evaluation committee last Friday before the agenda was published, and that's Chair DiGiovanni and Commissioner Kelly, and we reviewed the key components within the license agreement, also the appraisal, and they said they thought both looked good, and they even suggested to the board, or recommended to the board, to reduce the monthly fee from approximately 30 cents per square foot per month to 27 cents. Just to help out airport or in the transit district, and to consider that, you know, we're essentially, you know, letting another public agency park their vehicles here, so that's a good thing to do, and also that the vehicles are parked at an operating wastewater treatment plant. Anyways, so that's, you know, that's kind of briefly the staff report. So we have a draft license agreement that's been reviewed by everyone and recommended by the committee, and also as a handout is this Exhibit B, which is referenced in a couple places within the license agreement, and I noted in the staff report that it would be prepared, you know, early this week and handed out. And it's just some basic, you know, access protocols, both for Marin Airport and for CMSA, just the limitations that it will provide. Essentially, it will provide their bus drivers and staff with access cards so they can get into the main through the main access gate, through the corporation guard gate, through the person gate that will be installed in the fence surrounding the corporation yard. And it says if they lose it, they'll let us know, or if it's misplaced, let us know. And that they won't have access to any other CMSA facilities without a CMSA escort. And then, of course, we won't, you know, access their buses, you know, any of their vehicles or their storage container that they're planning to put on the site. So staff's recommendation is to approve the license agreement as presented or with revisions.
Any comments from the board?
Question. I'm concerned about termination. I mean, 5 years is a long time, and it doesn't look like there's any way for CMSA, if it needs that property for CMSA purposes, okay, to retake it. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe that... we probably just don't have a general, so we can terminate if we want.
Right.
So there's the default provision, environmental issues. I mean, we could add a provision that, for example, if we added item E that said CMSA may terminate the agreement if it is determined by the agency or by another governmental agency that we need to utilize a portion of the parking area for agency facilities or business, that we would provide Marin Airport or licensee with 120 days notice, something like that.
Yeah, certainly as much notice as possible, but just so that we would have...
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't think anything like that would happen, but it could happen. And if it did, you're right, it'd be good to have a provision where we could cite that.
Right,
instead of Larry saying, well, sorry, Jason, you can't terminate it.
You can't terminate it.
You can tell the Regional Water Board you just can't build that where you need to build it.
Yeah, exactly. So if we could do something like that, I think that would...
So I will add a 13E, given what I just presented.
That sounds great. We all can't predict the future. We probably won't use it, but it'd be nice to have it there.
Okay, thanks for bringing that up. That's good.
So I looked at this agreement, and... I thought it was really, really good, but it came to my attention, some of you may know, my previous line of work was work for Golden Gate Transit, so I had a little bit of knowledge about best practices for a facility like this, and I recalled that Golden Gate has a policy that addresses the the hazards of being in, exposed over long periods of time to diesel emissions. And I thought it might be prudent to have something like that in this agreement, just to make sure that our employees here weren't overly exposed to diesel emission exhaust. So I actually looked up something. I wasn't sure what that policy was at Golden Gate, so I looked up something. And CARB has a statewide policy that limits the idling of diesel engines to 5 minutes. And these, you know, these are these are regulations that were adopted many years ago, and the engines are much cleaner now than they were back then. But I think it would be reasonable to put a clause in the contract, in the lease, that that limits the idling time of engines to 5 minutes or so. So I'd like to put that forth as an amendment.
Do you see a problem?
I don't see a problem. I mean, just to address the underlying concern, all of the buses that we've been parking here, all of the diesel buses or hybrid buses, they're all at the moment less than 3 years old. They therefore have the SCR, selective catalytic reduction after treatment on them, so they're extremely clean emissions for a diesel engine. But I certainly take the point. We don't want people idling more than necessary in any event, because it just uses up fuel. Mm. They do need to do some idling, though, when they're pre-tripping buses first thing in the day, because they've got to build air in the air tanks with brakes and the suspension and so forth to be able to check their air pressure and make sure the brakes are working properly. And also sometimes, frankly, on a cold day, it's nice to warm up the bus a little bit before you start picking up passengers. But I would have thought a five-minute limit, which, as you point out, is in fact kind of mandated by the state anyway, is something we can live with.
Okay, I could, scrolling through the agreement,
yeah.
I could add under miscellaneous 22 on page 8, just another provision, just referencing in the math, the bus idling limits in the morning at startup, no more than 5 minutes, something like that. Doesn't really cleanly fit anywhere else. I just put it in this miscellaneous section.
That's fine.
Okay.
Any other comments from the board? Any comments from the public? Seeing none. By your motion?
I would move to, let me read this if I could. I'd move to approve the draft license agreement with Marin Airport with the edits suggested by the two commissioners.
Second.
Okay, before, one thing that we'll do is the agreement, you know, has a term that starts on the effective date. That's when I signed the agreement. But we wouldn't start invoicing Marin Airport until we've, CMC has completed all the on-site infrastructure improvements. So we need to install security cameras. We need to install the access gates. We need to get, we need to order and get the access cards, provide some training on that. We need to install the electronic, you know, card reader for the access gate. So that'll take some time. In concurrence to doing that, Larry had mentioned that they need to relocate some staff to their Anderson Drive facility. They need to train, you know, their bus drivers on some new protocols here. So I think those time periods will align pretty well. But once that's all done and we determine, you know, okay, we're ready to park buses here, then we'll start invoicing.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so we've had a motion and a second.
This is to authorize the general manager to
sign this document. Yes. So all in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? See you then.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Great. Thank you.
Good.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much.
I really like the idea of public agencies working together.
I love shared services. And you know, I think this helps you, and it certainly helps CMSA and its ratepayers.
We have another item like that later on in this agenda today. Okay, on to the next. Yeah, thank you. Item number 5.
Thank you.
Nominate and select commissioners for the commission chair, vice chair, and secretary offices, and appoint commissioners to the Standing Finance Committee and the Watershed Association Board of Directors.
Thank you. So this is an annual board activity, and it's usually done in July, even though we don't have a policy stating that. And that's where the board appoints its nominates and appoint officers, and that's, you know, the chair, the vice chair, and the secretary. Then they appoint commissioners or alternates to standing, you know, committees. We have one standing committee now. That's the finance committee. They usually meet, you know, twice a year or so. And they also appoint a representative to the North Bay Watershed Association's board of directors, and also appoint an alternate to that board. So last July, the board appointed Diane First as the chair, Michael Borson as vice chair, and Dean DiGiovanni as the secretary. Then in November, the SD2 board appointed council member Eli Beckman as Diane's replacement on the CMSA board. So November was Diane's last, you know, term, as last meeting and as chair of the agency. So in December, Vice Chair Borstein, you know, ran that meeting, and we had an item on the agenda to select a chair. So there was a good discussion, and Secretary DiGiovanni was appointed the chair. Michael stayed as the vice chair. Then we had a vacancy in the secretary. Then in January, we had an item to appoint the secretary, and Commissioner Beckman was appointed the secretary. So that's kind of how we got to the composition today. And that's the staff report.
I move we ratify those officers for fiscal year.
Well, hang on. I want to make a suggestion, and I have something to hand out. We'll hand out for everybody. We talked about this before, and that was, should we have a policy? And I think we should have a policy. So I'm suggesting a policy for the appointment of officers. And I'd like to suggest we look at the one that we passed recently at San Anselmo as an example. And let me say what we said in San Anselmo. The town shall appoint a mayor and vice mayor on an annual basis for a term of 1 year. The appointment should be made whenever it's made. They should be elected by affirmative vote of not less than three. In this case, I think that would remain the same, but we can talk about that. The mayor shall not serve two consecutive terms. I think we might tweak that to say the chair shall not serve two consecutive full terms, but that's... But I'd like to say we should suggest, I think, the following, that the vice chair is normally considered the next chair, that the treasurer is generally considered the next vice chair, but that if people don't agree with that, the bottom line was, we said in San Anselmo, the council may choose to appoint a person to the position of mayor, of chair, or vice chair based on factors other than that. For example, when we passed this very same resolution, we were passing over the vice chair, the vice mayor, which was Mayor Green. He was suing the town at the time. So while we had a policy to say the vice mayor became the mayor, we skipped it that very night, and for that very reason. So this commission may choose to appoint somebody based on any other position, but I'd like to see us talk about having a policy and having a one-year term. Now, having said that, we've had a half-year term here, so I'm not suggesting a half-year term should be considered a full-year term, and I would not make that suggestion at the end of that. But I want to open up a discussion for the policy.
Mike, my gut take on that. First of all, the comparability. I don't see the comparability, first of all, between this JP and any town or city council. I think they're very different animals. Just the frequency of the turnover recently leads me to believe we need maximum flexibility, however that's framed. So this is just my two takes.
Well, some of the other boards do the same thing, though. You know, CMSA is not different from Marin Municipal Water or Ross Valley Sanitary.
Well, it's just I'm the last person to ask, actually.
Yeah.
I'm just giving you my...
Because I know what we've done here in the past, in the more recent past, there have been like long-year appointments, which was, you know, it's one way of running things. Prior to that, this board did have a rotating position for a one-year term.
Well, I'm sure there can be correlations. Can you
look us beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, generally from like 1979 through like 2005 or 2006, generally, you know, the secretary moved up to the vice chair, and the vice chair went to the chair, and there was that rotation. And that all changed when, you know, there started to be some strange developments and tensions, you know, with the Ross Valley Sanitary District. then the board at the time decided that they really liked Bob Sinnott as the chair, and they kept appointing Bob Sinnott each year. as a chair. So that happened until he retired from the board. And then John Dupar from SD2 was, you know, the chair for the same reasons as Bob was for multiple years. And then when Bob, when John retired from the board, then Kathy Hartzell, sort of the same, and then Diane First. So that was kind of a practice that started in the 2005 and 2006 time frame because of the issues between some of the JPA members.
But Diane only served a half a year.
No.
I think she was a year and a half.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the history, you know, generally from 79 until now. So it was a certain way until 2005-6, then it's been a different way since then.
But always have developed because of a trusting, have sense about the relationships that required a flexibility.
Yeah, and so my suggestion, Dan, is not changing that flexibility. So in the example I've given here for the town of San Selmo, D is the flexibility. It says, in that case, the council. The council may choose to appoint a person in the position of, in that case, a mayor or vice mayor, based on factors other than that set forth in this very resolution. And we put that in for that very same reason, because that very same night, we weren't following this very same policy. We were passing over the vice mayor and appointing, in fact, a new mayor and a new vice mayor. So that was the flexibility that we requested to be written in, because you're right, it can't be written in that this is the way it's going to be. I agree with that. But I also don't think that we should have a policy where we have somebody sit for 5 years. That's, you know, I don't think that's fair to all the agencies. Well, I think we can look at that, but I don't think there's any reason why we shouldn't have a policy. That's my suggestion. Maybe the board doesn't agree with me.
I don't agree with you.
Okay.
We found in San Rafael that the stability of having a predictable leader on the city council.
Well, he's elected.
Right, he's elected. But we don't rotate. Rotating leadership tends to lead to unpredictability and inexperience in that important role. And the reason we decided annually to reappoint the incumbent on this board is that the incumbent was doing a great job, and we wanted it to stay that way. Creating a rotation in this very complex field with a lot of very day-to-day nuts and bolts sorts of questions that need to be answered and assistance that need to be rendered to the general manager would be, I think, contrary to the type of work that we do here. And if a particular board member is interested or in advancing into that position, I don't think there's ever been any objection to that, and to, you know, setting someone up in the vice position with the idea of moving on into the chair role. But it's a really important role, and for the last decade and a half, we've stuck with stability and not forced some sort of annual presumed upheaval. Every year, we always vote.
So you use the word upheaval, if I may just beg to differ on that. The only town council in the 11-member Marin that has a mayor that stays is yours, and that's by law. You can't be the mayor of San Selmo unless you run and get elected. So
right.
that's because the citizens of San Rafael vote for the mayor. Nobody's voting here as far as the citizens. So his board doesn't do it that way. His council doesn't do it that way. Nobody else does it that way. So the word upheaval is a little, you know. I mean, Dan's been mayor. I didn't think it was an upheaval. If he's elected mayor, I don't think that's going to be an upheaval. For his town.
Well, perhaps it's a different perspective, and I'm struggling to stay humble here, but we in San Rafael think that our city is run very well, and we like the stability of that, of this program. Here, I think we have a situation where it isn't broken. Why are we making changes? We have a very good chair right now that I would be prepared to nominate for the continuing as the chair, and I don't see any reason to change that at this point, and much less to create some sort of a presumption that there would be an annual turnover.
Okay.
perhaps one thing we might do is ask our general manager whether he thinks, as a matter of general principle, you know, not talking about any specific agency or board, and board members come and go anyway, but do you feel that an agency like CMSA might be hampered in its operations by regular rotation of a chair?
You know, I just think you're all great. I've worked with 36 just wonderful board members in my tenure here, and I've enjoyed it all. And the rotation, you know, worked fine with me. I would spend a lot of time with the new chair on getting up to speed, and having the consistency worked very well also. So I don't really have an opinion on it.
Can I just offer an observation?
Continues on.
I understand the leaning toward more versus less. There's a rules on stuff like this, mm-hmm. with this agency. But it's just been my experience that it really requires us to be able to trust each other to the extent that we can have a scenario, a continuing scenario like what she described, where everybody, they're not looking for these different positions as stepping stones, or we don't use seniority in this agency as a measure of hierarchy. So I think that's kind of an important principle that's helped us in the past, where that wasn't available to somebody to weaponize, for example.
Weaponize?
Well, if somebody wants, we don't know how the turnover works here, but we don't want somebody messing up that trust, because it's very visible if we have fewer rules and somebody steps out of line or is trying to, their interests are not the agency's interests. So that's just an observation.
Is there anybody on board you feel has that?
Not now.
Has there been in the last 5 years?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We. Yeah. I've got experience with all the member agencies since 2005. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why things have gone the way they have.
Right. My protecting. I think at some point, right, somebody's got to say that Ross Valley was a bad agency or run poorly, but at some point that's got to end. You can't just keep doing that forever.
I never said that. I said for anybody.
Right. Well, I think that's...
But my experience is that the range of potential things we need to react to include that.
Yeah. Well, listen, we had a particularly bad general manager.
This is not personal.
No, I understand. We
had a particularly bad general manager, and we sent over people over here before my time who did not play well in the sandbox, right, with anybody else.
See how it goes. Maybe you want to bring that back.
I don't know, you have votes today. We'll hear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm open to whatever anybody thinks. And, I think any of us here would be fine in that position, because this group is not adversarial, and we work with Jason.
Your opinion is important.
Okay.
So I see how it goes.
Well, I'm also trying to represent, you know, the district I represent has not been a chair in, you know, 15 years. It's a district that pays half the bills. I think it shouldn't be necessarily locked out for the next 20 years. I just don't think that's...
Are you the chair?
It's the chair right there.
Yeah. Tonight.
I don't think anybody wants to change that.
He's the vice chair.
Well, he's acting chair.
Well, I'm not a good actor.
All right, let's move on.
Just North Bay Watershed Association. I like doing it. It's really cool. I've been doing it, how long? Officially a year, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if anybody else...
You're an alternate before that.
Yeah, if anybody else wanted to, would be there. And I would highly recommend anybody just show up and watch it, because we've just had some amazing stuff people coming recently. So if nobody else wants it, I would be pleased to do it again.
Do you want to ask Alan or Larry or Eli what they think of your concept?
I think they could have spoken up.
Yeah, I have no strong opinion. I can see both sides of it.
Let's bring it up again next year.
Same here. I'm aware that Dean would like to retain.
Well, I wouldn't have suggested Dean be removed after half a year anyway. So that, let me be clear about that. That wouldn't have been fair, and I wouldn't have suggested that. In fact, I'd rather, let me do this. Let me nominate Dean to remain as chair for the next 12 months. Do we have a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded.
Yeah. Oh,
well, do we want to include the others?
Should we go straight down and then do it all in one fell swoop?
Sure.
Okay, vice chair.
All right, I'll nominate Michael Borstein as vice chair.
Second.
Commission secretary.
Eli Beckman.
Second.
Nominate.
Second.
Standing.
I'm doing a good job.
Yeah.
Standing finance committee.
I don't think there's anything wrong there. I think that we've got three.
I'll nominate the current opposition. Yeah.
And Tom Gaffney is just the smartest finance guy that I know. He is so good.
He's very good. I have a question.
Yes, sir.
For the standing finance committee, mm-hmm. and I should have done some work ahead of time, but I was wondering if the finance committee would be opposed to having an observer from San Rafael Sanitation District, our alternate Alan, occasionally attend meetings as sort of a training opportunity.
The finance committee is always good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a standing committee, so there's agendas noticed and it's open to the public.
Hold on. But because of the Brown Act, if a member of the commission attends, he cannot participate.
Right, the non-voting observer.
It can't speak either.
It's an educational.
Yeah.
Or if you're with the Marin Municipal Water District.
Yeah, no. It's just we learned that in ours first, and then we learned about it from Marin Municipal. That you can't, you're a pot plant, which is, it's good to go, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Just one big thing.
And in fact, over at Ross Valley, where I often go to the finance committee meetings, I'm not even allowed to ask a question as a public.
That's the whole point I was making. That's he can't groan. He can't make
questions. Right, but he's a member, is an alternate. Does that apply to even to an alternate?
I think that would fit the Brown Act. Yeah. I got the Brown Act in the car when you pull it out.
Sorry.
I don't need to groan either.
I love the idea of
he should
as many one. Public, everybody showing up to these meetings instead of once every 5 years, they say, what? And, you know, no, if he'd have been attending the meetings, more. Anyway, yes, absolutely. Okay, so, and then North Bay Watershed Association.
I nominate yourself.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, all in favor of that slate?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Seeing none?
We still have an alternate to North Bay Watershed Association Board of Directors.
You've done it?
I'm fine if someone would like to take that seat. That's cool.
I think Dean expressed some interest in that as well.
So moved.
Is there any problem having him on as an alternate as well?
And if the two of you can't
yes,
go.
Yes, he said he'd like to be an alternate.
I nominate Dean as an alternate. And that way, if one can't go, the other one could go.
Sure.
Okay.
You don't have to have
alternate.
I could be the second alternate.
Yeah, that's it. That's right.
The alternate.
The alternate.
Okay.
All right. So, do you have to vote again?
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Item number six.
We still have the finance committee. Do we have the same slate?
We have that same slate.
No, the six over here.
And item number six, asset management program evaluation presentation.
Okay. So the agency has done just a really good job maintaining, our agency staff, maintaining our assets, our equipment, our processes since we started up our operation back in 1985. And a lot of, the records you know, for what work we've been doing, what we've done, and, you know, planning for preventative maintenance and other activities. It was all paper-based for decades. And then it shifted to Excel spreadsheets. And then in around 2005, moved to more database-type programs, which has improved the efficiency and functionality, you know, of our program. If you call back in October, you know, you approved an agreement with GHD to do an evaluation of our current asset management program, which included some staff training, you know, gap analysis, and then identifying some areas that we could consider for improvements. So that's pretty much been wrapped up. So here tonight, we have our celebrity, Amy, and Chris Fenton, our treatment plan manager, to give you an overview of our asset management program and some of the findings from the evaluation report and what we're going to be doing the next year or so.
Okay, well, thank you, Jason, for the introduction. Hello, my name is Amy, and with me is Chris. And we'll be presenting on a status update of our asset management program evaluation project. So a brief outline of what we'll be discussing today. We'll start with discussing what is asset management, then move into our asset management history here, how we currently manage our assets, and move into GHD's evaluation of our asset management program, and discuss our next steps moving forward. So what is asset management? It's really a process to make sure that staff can conduct proper planned maintenance of our assets, making sure we have a plan in place to repair or replace or upgrade our capital assets, such as pumps, motors, and pipes, and making sure also to that we have enough money to pay for all these services. So you can really think of asset management as a balancing act of these three core items. We're trying to always keep the cost of service, acceptable risk, low, while still maintaining our level of service. So what does that really mean? To get a better understanding, we can try comparing two different types of assets here. First, let's take an example of a simple bathroom fan. What's the level of service for a fan? It's to provide ventilation. The cost of service associated with it is really just the initial upfront cost for purchasing the fan, and then if it fails, we replace it. There's really not a special inspection that we have to do to upkeep. The acceptable risk. Do we really have one? Not really. We run the fan until it dies. Different type of asset here. Let's look at our 82-inch outfall into the San Francisco Bay. The level of service is to discharge the treated effluent safely to mix well with the bay waters. But there's an associated cost to maintain this. So we have to provide yearly inspections by hiring a contractor to expose any buried diffuser valves. And with that, we have a high risk because maybe a complete burial of the diffusers could mean that the water starts back flowing into our plant. And so we have to conduct yearly inspections to make sure we maintain our outfall.
These inspections, and even going inside the outfall, removing settled solids is really important. It costs a lot of money, but it's to maintain that level of service. But a couple of stories. When I first started here, we could only get like 60 MGD through the outfall, and you should be able to get like 140 at low tide. So we sent divers out, and we found that half of the 1,000-foot-long diffuser section was plugged full of solids that got in through the diffusers and filled up that area. And there's a tapering, you know, gradient of solids. So we had to go in and remove all that solids to restore capacity. Mm-hmm. And we're just fortunate at that time, this is back in like 1994, that we didn't, you know, have a huge storm event where the flows would have exceeded 60 or 70 and we would have spilled water on the plant. Mm-hmm. Another example is back in December 31st, 2005, you know, we had these, you know, huge rain events, and this was a disaster zone declared by the governor. And we saw 100 MGD come to the plant for a 24-hour sustained period. And at that time, the outfall's capacity was 90 at a low tide. So we had 100 coming in for a 24-hour period. It means we went through two high tide cycles. So we filled up all the tanks. We filled up the pond. This was the pond that had a lot less volume than it is now. And the water kept coming in, and water started spilling out of the contact tanks, down the steps, down into our storm drain system. The pond was filled. So we decided then, well, let's just let the pond overflow. There was a kind of lower area into the storm drain system and flow out to the wetlands behind where the Home Depot is now, instead of just spilling out, you know, other places. But there's just a couple of examples of why it's really important to maintain the level of service of that asset, to maintain the hydraulic capacity so we can move all the flows out.
You know, like, are you only doing an inspection on this once a year?
Yeah, we actually recently just finished our diver inspection.
And, yeah, that's always done by human being.
Yes. Be certified.
So we'll kind of go into a little bit of the history of our asset management program. So the agency developed our first strategic business plan back in 2004, and concurrently we purchased our first computerized maintenance management program software. In 2007, we developed our strategic asset management program, and based on lessons learned from the implementation of that program, we purchased a new asset management software package, NextGen, in 2009. What NextGen does differently than Maintenance Connection, it combines a CMMS, or Computerized Maintenance Management System, with advanced asset management planning tools. So combine those together. And in order to highlight some of the agency's asset management program in 2011, we began providing the board with asset management quarterly reports and then periodic presentations during the first several years of the program to highlight milestones within the program. Since 2007, our maintenance staff is focused on core asset management. We now know what we own. We know that we have a little over 2,000 assets that we manage. More importantly, we know what their condition is and what condition our assets are in. We've shifted from reactive to corrective maintenance. And more importantly from there, we know the costs for labor and materials for all of our assets. So since 2007, out of the 13 staff who received original asset management training, there's only one left. That's why I'm up here giving this presentation. So one of those. Our plan has always been to further develop our asset management program, but that's been hampered with retirements and recruitments, which basically kept us focused more on our core asset management principles. So again, with board approval in 2018, we hired GHD Engineering to evaluate our program and ultimately provide focused training to our staff on broader asset management practices and principles.
Okay. Yep. Okay, so then let's discuss how we currently manage assets here, but on the maintenance level. So what you're seeing right here is a screenshot of our asset management software, the one that Chris just described, called NextGen. And to help you understand what our staff is doing daily to manage our assets, I'm gonna take an example of a pump shown here. So specifically, we're looking at the digester mixing pump number one. So to find this pump, our staff will begin by utilizing this asset tree here. Like Chris said, we have over 2,000 assets here, and those assets at our facility are categorized into 21 different areas at our facility. So to get to this specific pump, we're going to go down into Area 13, the area for our digesters. And you can see here that even within Area 13, we have all these different categories of assets. But to get to the pumps, we'll go down to Area 13 pumps, click the drop down, and even in pumps, we'll have all these different types of pumps. So what we're looking at here is this blue one, digester mixing pumps, and specifically pump number one. So we found our pump. Then next, they can begin to put in general information specific to the pump, like when was it installed, what was the purchase cost, what could be the replacement cost. We can also put in information on what are called child assets, which are specific to this broader parent asset. So having information on a child asset, in this case it's a motor, right next to the pump, it's really useful for our staff because usually when we need information on something like a pump, it's nice to have information on the motor right next to it. So in this case, all they have to do is click here, and that'll take them to a page that looks very similar to this, but with all the information on the motor. Next, they can also put in parts necessary to service this pump, as well as any documents specific to the pump, like O&M manuals, pump curves, vendor information, things like that. And then scrolling further down, we'll get you to the work order section. This is where staff puts in all the time spent working on this pump, when they did the work, and description of all of their different activities. Okay, so that was the maintenance side. We also manage assets on the broader project side. The tables you're seeing here is from the condition assessment done by Corolo as part of their master plan, our facilities master plan project. You may recall Jason provided a presentation on that in the earlier part of 2018. But as part of the condition assessment, they provided us with all of these different types of projects to implement. And they are ranked right now based on their inherent risk score. And risk is calculated by multiplying the probability of failure by the consequence of failure. So higher the risk, the more critical the project, the faster we should implement them. So let's take an example of a specific project. The secondary clarifiers rehab project. You can see it's fairly high on the risk scale. So we dedicated a major project description for this project in our CIP. And here we describe what the project is about and why we need to do this project. Essentially, it involves coating a lot of the inner mechanical parts inside the secondary clarifiers, what you see here, resurfacing some of the concrete and the weirs, and replacing the drive unit. And here it talks about the risk associated and our schedule for how we want to implement this project. So right now we have the design to be complete this year with construction to be phased out over the next 4 years for each of our secondary clarifiers. So taking those list of projects from the condition assessment, we incorporate them into our 10-year CIP. You may be familiar with this. You can see that the project is listed here with design in FY20 and construction over 4 years. So that's kind of the thought process that went into making our CIP. So evaluation by GHD. Like Chris said earlier, we wanted to evaluate our program, and so we made a specific action in our FY19 business plan to hire a consultant to evaluate our program and recommend any improvements. So Chris and I developed the scope of work. We prepared a request for proposals, circulated that to various consultants, reviewed them all, and then we asked the board to award the contract to GHD in October of last year. So the project really involves three key tasks. First is provide training to our staff, and then conduct what's called a gap analysis, which is really just comparing where we stand in asset management today versus where we want to be, and then prepare an implementation plan or a roadmap for us to move forward. We'll talk about all of these three soon, but right now we have completed these first two tasks, and we're in this phase, the roadmap phase, and that's in draft form right now, and it should be finalized soon. The training. So GHD provided two training sessions for us. First was for all staff members. It was really just an awareness training to revisit basic principles of asset management. And then the second training session was just for key O&M staff where we received more detailed asset management principle information. So we got more technical.
I attended that six-hour staff training. It was very enlightening and worthwhile. Refresh my memory, all the stuff I learned back in 2005. I forgot.
How many people attended that?
I think about, you know, what, two-thirds of our staff, maybe?
At least, yeah.
All the day shift staff.
Okay. So that was a training. And then the gap assessment. We also participated in gap assessment workshops. And during each of these workshops, what we essentially did was go through this table here. So there are 35 different asset management practice areas. So for each of those areas, we sat down and gave ourselves a score or a ranking on how we are doing in that particular area with GHD's help. Then we have the findings column where we write down what we are doing currently. And GHD took that information and populated this field here, notified or sent. It's a gap. And that's really just the distance between our current asset management practices and the overall best management practices of asset management. So that's the gap that they identified. Then with all of that information of the different 35 practice areas, we narrowed down to 11 practice areas that we wanted to focus on, that we wanted to improve on. And we really chose these 11 because these were what were relevant and important to us, what we wanted to improve on. And so the 11 are shown here. And we decided to work on these two practice areas for immediate implementation in FY20. So what do these really mean? Practice area number 7, process for managing asset knowledge, is really saying have a procedure in place to identify critical assets. Because once those are identified, you can start putting in condition assessment data. And once that's in place, we can establish a review and approval process. So once the process is in place, number 8, asset data and knowledge, is setting up asset lifecycle plans for those critical assets identified from here, and making sure that we establish a replacement versus refurbishment schedule. So we identified these two for FY20, but we chose really these two to implement right away because these practice areas will allow us to make improvement tasks straight in NextGen. So that has really 3 benefits because 1, our staff use NextGen every day. They're very familiar with it. 2, that means that we can do the tasks to improve these two areas mostly in-house. And 3, we can see immediate results of any of our changes. So we get immediate feedback on what we may be doing well versus not. So once that's in place, we can begin to develop specific tasks for these other 9 remaining practice areas for implementation in the next 5 years from FY21 through 25. So, before I go on, now Chris is going to talk about examples of what this may look like in next year.
So using our digester mixing pump as an example, you can see here, we have a long history at CMSA of managing our assets and understanding the costs to managing these assets. What GHD identified specifically and what we plan to focus on in this year's strategic business plan is right here, is what they identified is we weren't fully utilizing our asset management program. Specifically, we weren't populating these modules and organizing our data the way that they thought we should with our program. And I'll give you an example right here. Here's that pump's life cycle asset plan with unorganized. It's just this large block that gives you a year and a replacement cost. Now, if we organize our data, that same example, now you can see that we have our annual costs for maintenance, our major maintenance costs with the life, over the life, and then ultimately the replacement cost at 15 years. So just a better way of organizing the data.
So then finally, our next steps, we'll implement those two FY20 tasks in-house. And I wanted to share this graph with you all. This is a knowledge transfer graph. At the beginning of the project, we may have started out at this point where our CMSA staff time is is shown by this darker blue line. Our involvement may have been on the fairly low side at the beginning of the project with external resources lead, which would be GHD in this case, on the higher end. But our hope is that as the project progresses and moving into the future, we'll be making our way more towards this area at the knowledge transfer point where our staff can begin to take the lead and implement future tasks in-house with little to no outside help. And then finally, we'll incorporate those tasks into our FY20 strategic business plan as specific actions under Goal 1, Objective 1.2, managing the agency's assets. Plans moving forward. Any questions?
Wonderful presentation.
Oh. So, Salesforce product that you use?
What's that?
Your program, is that from Salesforce?
The our maintenance management since NextGen. Mm-hmm. No, I believe it's just that it's a individual product that was developed.
Yeah, it uses a lot of same.
Oh, it does it? Like,
yeah,
a lot of
the
code.
Any other questions?
Overwhelmed.
I think I want to see how this is in a year. You know, it's obviously, tracking your
important assets is critically important. It lessens the surprises. Can't predict the future, but you can look into it a little bit.
Exactly.
Is there any way we can track how cost effective it is? Cost savings or comparators, once this is simply, compare years or something, or groups of years, with this in place?
This is in place. Are you talking about just the two activities for this current fiscal year?
Yeah, I guess. And the different activities as they're put into place, on some sort of an understanding of and demonstration. I mean, we all think this is extremely cost effective, but it would be nice to see it.
Well, if you look back, say, 2004 through 2008 or so, when we didn't have, an asset management software program, and we were focused on the computerized maintenance management aspect of it, we did a lot more corrective maintenance. So something would break or something, starts to have a smell to it because oil's burning or it's vibrating. Then we have to go and fix it. And we, through the implementation of the asset management program and the enhanced maintenance, we shifted from corrective maintenance to preventative maintenance. So now we're in a much more preventative maintenance mode. And by doing that, the costs for maintaining that asset are a lot less than they are on the corrective side. And we used to have, some of those metrics, a decade ago. But now we've shifted to where we're pretty efficient with the preventative maintenance work. And a lot of that information is shown in the quarterly asset management report, where it shows what it'll have project, bigger projects, and, the cost and the staff time. Then it'll highlight projects by area also, asset management-related projects that are done, little descriptions of the cost. So we show that there. But we don't really have a comparison now about, if we didn't do the preventive maintenance, what would it be on the corrective side? All we can say is that it's a lot less due to preventive maintenance than fixing something that's failed, having to replace it because you didn't maintain this properly. That's my general answer.
Right, but maybe that's the exact answer. And that is corrective maintenance, how it's gone down.
Yeah.
And how the mix has changed so much. And maybe that's your metric to show how well your asset management program is working, is that your corrective maintenance is going to zero. So, just a thought.
Yeah, it's important. There's always some corrective maintenance. It's zero.
Things are pretty well. It's going down.
Like our cogen engine, that was pretty well maintained. That's a big corrective maintenance cost.
Too soon.
But thanks for that.
Okay. Any more discussion?
Great job. Thanks, Amy. Appreciate you
having me.
Thank you.
Did we already celebrate her for her awesome?
Yes,
we did.
Oh, yeah.
I missed that.
We
should get a billboard on Anderson Avenue. Okay. Agenda item 7, proposed fiscal year 20 agency business plan. Mr. Rao.
Thank you. So, as briefly mentioned this afterward, back in July 2016, the board concluded a process which took about a year to develop the agency's third five-year strategic business plan. And this plan was a little different format than the prior two five-year plans, where the board worked in a series of workshops to develop, the vision statement, where we want to go, the mission statement, what we're here for, what's our purpose, and new value statements. That's what's important to the agency. And associated with those were agency-wide goals, which were more board policy statements in these core areas. And then, so that was a strategic five-year plan. Then what the board authorized was each year develop an annual business plan that has objectives, which are more specific than the goals, but they align with the goals, and it has actions, we call strategic actions. And those could be activities, tasks, projects, or even bigger programs of how we attain the objective that aligns with the goal and that achieves the vision and mission and is aligns with the values of the agency. So this is the fourth year of developing an annual business plan to support the overall five-year strategic plan. And so attached tonight is the proposed plan, and this was developed by a 14-member agency strategic planning committee, which is comprised of staff, from all the departments at the agency. And the objectives in the proposed plan are very similar to the objectives that are in the FY19 plan. There were five that were revised, and there was a new one. So if you look at on the staff report, page one, item B is a new one, and the others were just revisions or combinations of other objectives because we completed a lot of the actions under those individual objectives. So the plan itself, before you, has 6 goals, and those have been consistent since the 5-year plan was developed. It has 18 objectives and 68 actions. And what I did is, in the plan, there's highlights for the actions that I thought were noteworthy, but that was my opinion. So I could go through, you know, the plan with you. I could touch on the highlighted ones, or if you've all reviewed it, you could just consider approving it, however you guys would like to proceed.
Well, I did sit down with you yesterday and review this, and I think it's great. I think it's well done, well designed. So I don't have any further questions for myself.
Any other more comments?
I reviewed it this afternoon. I think it's great.
Perfectly consistent.
Yes. Good. So, any comments from the public?
I'll move that we approve the fiscal year 2020 agency business plan.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Number 8.
Great, thank you. We'll start working on this tomorrow. Actually, a lot of these things we're already working on.
Tyler Technologies, financial system software procurement.
So this is an item that is kind of it's the conclusion of an FY19 business plan item. And a little story. So, you know, Ken Spray, our admin services manager, you know, after he graduated college, he was an accountant for, you know, several years. And when he was an accountant, he worked on our audit. And then he came to CMSA as an accountant. They were a small admin finance group. And then I was hired in 93, so I got to know Ken. Then he left in 1999, and he was with Valeo as finance director for 17 years, went to Millbrae for a little while. He came back to CMSA, so it was great to see Ken again. And when he came back, he said, well, you know, Jason, you guys are using the same financial software package when I started here. And it was in place already for 5 years before I got here. And I said, oh, yeah, oh, I didn't even know that, Ken. Things just always got done, you know, by the staff. So he was talking about, you know, at Valeo and Millbrae, and there's a Bay Area wastewater finance group, also an HR group, and they talk about all these various finance matters, and they're always, you know, sharing information about, you know, financial software and who's using what and the benefit of it, functionality. So he started interfacing with the group, and eventually this item got into the FY19 business plan. And it was more of an evaluation of financial software alternatives. So it was doing a needs assessment internally, working with stakeholders, and it was identifying different types of software packages. Some Ken knew about, some they got from, you know, this regional, you know, finance group, and then preparing an RFP and getting proposals from, you know, 6 different vendors, and then doing a detailed evaluation. The evaluation included, you know, just reviewing the proposal itself, using criteria, kind of like what we talked about a minute on the Cogent side, and also, you know, interviewing, you know, all of the vendors. And then this project team winnowed it down to 3, and they had what Ken called deep dives, and that's really getting into details, inviting the vendors to come in, and they gave 2 to 3 hour presentations about how all the different modules worked, and engaged our staff in questions and answer sessions. And so it was unanimous with the project team, and then the ASPC, and then managers and other stakeholders that this Tyler Technologies software package was great, and Ken checked with, you know, several. There's numerous wastewater and water agencies that use this software package in the Greater Bay Area. I think he contacted 4 or 5. Some are listed in here. They gave just great references. They said it's easy to use, it's functional, you can customize reports. Didn't have a bad downside to it that they shared with Ken anyways, and said that they provide great service, you know, support if you have any questions or need something kind of reprogrammed. So that was the conclusion of the evaluation. So, you know, we got a proposal from Tyler, actually from the top 3, and it was $135,000 for the procurement, the license, and all of the startup support services, you know, data transfer, customizing as needed, training staff over a period of time this coming fiscal year. So that cost was $135,000, which is similar to the other 2 packages also. And so we brought that to the finance committee at the end of April as part of our discussion of the draft budget. And that was one of the key questions we had was, here's the conclusion of this business plan item and, you know, the valuation and proposal, and Ken attended that meeting. He was able to, you know, explain, you know, kind of the, some of the shortfalls of our current older program and some of the benefits and functionality and customization reports and other benefits of the new program. And the committee thought, well, that looks great. We think that we'll recommend that to the board. Go ahead and include it in the budget. So we did that and talked about a little bit, you know, very briefly during my presentation in May. So it's in the capital plan right now, the purchases. So the recommendation is to approve the contract with Tyler, and the contract's attached. And we had Bill McNerney, our contract attorney, review this, and he thought it looked pretty good. There's a few revisions he suggested, and Tyler, you know, accepted those and made those revisions. And so the recommendation is to approve the contract. However, you know, I was gone for a couple of weeks of my family vacation where I caught all these colds in the back of a plane with about 50 kids. And then I got back, and Ken's gone for his annual family vacation to Europe. So we weren't going to talk about this too much. So I don't have any detailed, you know, information about the software's modules besides, you know, the staff saying, finance staff saying it's great. And but I was talking with some other staff today, and there were some questions that they had about, you know, like the purchase order module and this and how that is compatible with NextGen, because a lot of our staff use NextGen's mm-hmm. purchase order because all that data then is used in the work orders and mm-hmm. the purchase orders and the Strat. Mm-hmm. And will they talk with each other? And if they don't, can they be modified the program to talk so that way that purchase order information can flow into the module used by the financial software? So I didn't have answers to this, but... So tonight, I'm not quite sure how we should proceed if we want to just table this until September so we can answer some of these questions and either say everything's great, there's solutions.
Yes.
Or if we want to, you know, authorize me to figure out the solutions that approve this or modified agreements, whatever the board's comfortable doing, I'm fine with, you know, holding off until September or kind of a staff level kind of figuring out what we need to do, if anything. On, you know, the purchase order side. I just heard about this today, and I didn't feel good about just signing this particular contract without, you know, Ken being here, without talking with NextGen, without talking with our staff, without talking with Tyler about some of the questions that came up.
If we do that, that doesn't affect the critical path anywhere.
No. It's just the finance staff are really eager to get this and start, you know, getting trained and stuff. But, you know, it definitely can be, you know, held until September until we answer some of these questions, and either everything's fine, there could be solutions, or maybe, you know, there's a modification of this where we don't use our purchase order, or I'm just not quite sure. But there's enough questions that I wasn't comfortable with saying this is a fine contract with all this scope of work.
Well, given the presentation that we just received on the asset management on the software and the abundance of data there and how it is designed to track costs.
Yeah.
It would seem to me that this is a really important functionality for both systems. They've got to be able to work well together. I mean, and ideally, to some extent, if new costs, that the data flow would go both ways. So if a bolt cost 10 cents when something went in and now it costs 15 cents, that it would automatically update those cost estimates. So, I mean, these two systems have to work well together. So if it can be delayed without inconveniencing the systems, the operations, I think that would be the best course. If we can have a rock solid answer.
Sure.
I have a question about the maintenance and support. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I had a question over here.
So, on a similar, you know, track as Mary Beth's, it sounds like this functionality, this interface between the next gen and the financial system is important. And so my question is, was it one of the evaluation criteria? Mm-hmm. And if it was, why is it just now kind of coming to light? And if it wasn't, then maybe we do need to go back a step and make sure that we're choosing the right financial system that ensures that functionality before we actually approve it.
No, I agree. And I can't answer any of those questions because I wasn't involved in the evaluation process at all. I just got feedback about, you know.
So it seems prudent to delay the action.
Yeah.
Is maybe the correct person could answer whether the maintenance and support agreement is described, and this is the best we can do.
You know, I suggested to Jason, because it's $20,000 annually for 7x24, which in my business, like service bars and restaurants, they need it at 3 o'clock in the morning. What I said is maybe if we go forward with this, maybe pay the first year, but I wanted him to ask questions as to what happens after the first year if we find out we've never called you on a night or weekend ever about our accounting software.
Well, I just want to know if this is the state of the art. Because you're paying, they say unless you're paying the payments of the maintenance support agreement, they're throwing you under the bus. Because you get priority on calls. And
yeah,
but if it doesn't work, I mean.
Yeah, I think part of the part
is subject to your payments of the maintenance support agreement.
Part of this is that you definitely need some type of maintenance support agreement. That is critical. 24/7, I'm not quite sure about that. But Ken and her staff reviewed maintenance support, and they thought it was adequate. I don't know what they compared against or anything, but they thought it was fine.
Okay. Well, I just want to know if that's the best we can do. If it is, then okay.
Yeah. For that price, I think.
It reads a little bit like a hostage situation.
But it sounds like we all would like to get more information.
Yeah.
And so we can, if it's available at the next
meeting. Yes,
do we generally agree that since it's not mission critical at this point, and waiting 2 months might make a good idea, and would anybody like to make a motion? Do we need to make a motion?
I move that we continue item 8 until the next meeting.
Yep. I second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
I want to comment that Commissioner Zaradnik had. We did look at, you know, which software would have also an asset management component to it, and Tyler has an asset management module. But we decided not to pursue that because it was a high cost for that module, and we had, you know, the next gen, and there's been a huge investment, you know, staff time and effort, you know, customizing that, getting that populated, and we decided let's focus on the financial side, make sure that's up and running fine, and then in the future, if we want, we could consider the asset management.
You might just let Ken know that he should address that issue at this
meeting. Yeah, I would think that would be part of the valuation, but I just don't know. The questions that were asked today, I was just interested in that. We should probably hold off.
I have one more question, Mr. Chair. the NextGen replace the activity management software that we saw that was so helpful to understand how people were using their time and focusing on a particular task.
That's all. NextGen tracks all of that.
So that's all in the next.
Yeah. I mean, people, timesheets. For our field staff, a lot of timesheets are in the NextGen. So work order time that's completed, that gets fed into the timesheets, and that eventually gets over to the finance.
So that's all in a more detailed relationship to what we saw.
Yeah, what you saw is just, you know, there's a snapshot over you. There's a lot more depth to all of those little boxes that she was highlighting, you know, on that one screen.
We saw on the ground examples of how data was input some years ago.
During the board presentation?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, probably, you know, there was like for 5 years we had asset management presentations about the current program.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure everything, like, I don't use the word functionality that often in my daily discussions, but that's the best word.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk to Kim when he comes back about that.
Okay, agenda item 10. New cogeneration system pre-purchase evaluation criteria.
Okay. So this is just kind of a follow-up to our discussion last month. So you remember the final design for the cogen system installation project was approved. Part of that was the cogen system pre-purchase documents, and we selected the size of the engine. We had our kickoff meeting, and then we told the board last month that we're planning to have a vendor selected and a recommendation to award a contract to them either September or October. And that before we did that, though, we'd want to bring the proposed proposed RFP evaluation criteria to the board just to get your thoughts on it and concurrence or acceptance. So this, so Corona and staff put this table together, and there's several items. The first item is just a pass or fail. Does it meet the minimum efficiency, which is 40%? Do they have, you know, is there a system of a track record running on biogas, you know, in California? Can it blend natural gas and biogas together, even though we don't see ourselves doing that in the future, but it's good to have that functionality. Do they meet minimum specification requirements? If it's no, then they're not going to be considered. If it's yes, okay, then they'll move on. Then we have some general information about, you know, where's their repair facility, you know, do they have a list of references we can call, or are those references going to say good things? You know, what kind of experience do they have? Then it looks more specifically to the technical specifications. Do they meet all the technical specifications, and how closely do they meet, and were there going to be exceptions? So there's some weighting on that, or a score on that. Then we have what's the actual capital cost of the overall system. You know, like we looked at like $1.5 million in some examples, you know, a couple months ago. And then additional capital cost, what's your maintenance schedule? So what's those maintenance costs? And then we'll do a net present value calculation, which is over a time period, like 10 or 20 years. What's the capital cost to buy it? And what are all these maintenance costs over time based on your preventive maintenance schedule? Bring those back to a point in time using some rate of return. So then we have, you know, these ranges of points. So those are our criteria that we use, and these are kind of our point ranges. We might refine the point ranges once we receive some of the proposals. But anyways, this is just for information, just get your feedback, and hopefully your acceptance of these.
Any more feedback? Questions? My recollection of our discussion, you thought the location was a pretty significant criteria.
You know, I believe that was the discussion of this the next item, which was selecting the alternative for replacing the scale of engine. You know, remember, we staff thought it was important that, you know, we consider the San Leandro facility, but it was a lot more money and less engine, and we decided to go with the Ohio rebuilt engine, right, because it was a full engine instead of just, you know, kind of the lower end. So I think that was part of that discussion.
I see.
Even though the local facility would work on the new engine also.
Say this is an improper relationship.
Yeah, yeah. The location here would be, so if it's a Caterpillar, you know, engine, where is their local repair facility?
Mm-hmm.
If it's a Jenbacher, where their facility? Jenbacher says, well, anything happens, you're going to have to ship it back to Germany. Well, they're not going to get many points for that. But if they say, we have a place, you know, in Reading, and the other major manufacturer is Caterpillar, they say, well, we have a place in Modesto, then, you know, they might be pretty close in score, as a general example.
Thank you.
So I'm looking at these as weighting factors, and the majority of them, you know, up to 75 points, are on cost. So it's really about cost. And the comparison is roughly 2-to-1 capital to maintenance costs.
Yeah.
So that's is that consistent with your, I guess, values of the cogen engine, that a dollar spent on capital is only worth, is the same as 50 cents on ongoing costs.
No, I don't think it's meant, you know, to kind of mean that. Okay. It just, we're just looking at we're just trying to come up with some points, and we thought, you know,
because
most of the time, you know, you guys know about evaluative bids and things like that, but a lot of times people just think, geez, you're going to buy something, it's always the lowest bidder.
Right.
That only applies to, you know, public projects in the contract code. So we know cost is important, so we always, you know, put a higher factor based on cost. But then we know that, well, maintenance is pretty important too. So you say, for example, like Jenbacher says, okay, you have to do this maintenance activity every year, and we know it's like $5,000. And every 3 years, you do this one for $60,000. And Calvert says, well, you only have to do this one every 3 years at $1,000, and this one every 6 years at $60,000. Mm-hmm. Then we do that kind of cost analysis over time that brings the maintenance element into it. Mm-hmm. And we think that's important to consider that, because mm-hmm. we definitely don't want to be spending a lot, you know, over time out of the capital budget for preventative maintenance. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the weighting we thought. We think that's important, but the capital cost we're paying right now is more important right now than the ongoing maintenance costs.
And the bulk of the costs are in the capital?
Yeah. I mean, if you look, say, at a 10-year time period, so when I say the maintenance costs, I mean, you know, maintenance when you bring in a contractor to do the maintenance, not our staff's maintenance, because we'll do a lot of that internally. So the capital on these engines might be like $1.4 million. And say a top-end overhaul, at least using an example of our current engine, that might be $50,000. Oh. And that might be every, you know, I don't know, 4 years. If I had a maintenance person, they'd tell us. But that might be every, you know, 20,000 hours. Then you might have a full overhaul every 40,000 hours, then a major overhaul every 70,000 hours. Okay. So then you know the kind of, you know, one's, you know, 50,000, one's, you know, 70, and one's like 150. So you can spread that out over time. Those are important costs. We don't think there's going to be a big difference between the two, you know, major manufacturers that meet the minimum criteria, at least the way we're looking at it now. That's why it has lower points too.
Okay.
And it may be where when we get their proposals, the maintenance schedules are almost similar, we may change this criteria. And we may shift more to capital costs. Mm-hmm. This is kind of just up to. So we kind of, we stay like that, so that way the vendors can't, you know, manipulate some of the cost information to get more points. Some agencies in the past have said, this is worth 8 points, this is worth 10 points. So people could, you know, make sure the proposals align with the most points. So we have flexibility there. Or, you know, we could even, you know, we've done this in the past, we don't even have any point ranges. We say, just here's the criteria. Then we generate, you know, the points ranges after we, you know, get the proposals. We've done it both ways in the past. We've never been very specific, but we've either adhered to the criteria, kind of general, just a description of them, like in the middle column, or here's the criteria and here's these potential ranges. We've done it both ways, but not point numbers for each criteria.
I kind of like the way it got.
Who might be some of the 3 to 5 other engine suppliers? I mean, are they... For example, Germany, is that an example?
Actually, you know what, that's actually a typo. There was an edit made here that didn't make it into the packet. There's only 2 to 3. So, like, for example, Waukesha, mm-hmm. our current manufacturer, they make an engine that's, you know, 950, you know, kilowatts, but that engine's only 30% efficient. It's not 40%. And it may be a little less money, but you're going to get, you know, 25% more output from the more efficient engine mm-hmm. with the same biogas flow, something okay. like that.
Right.
So there's you know, Waukesha, there's Cummins, and there's another manufacturer that makes engines that operate on biogas, but they're not the newest generation engines that have the highest energy efficiency.
Okay.
So that's really important to us.
Absolutely.
So it's in the specification, it's going to say something like, I haven't seen it yet, but like minimum 40% or 39 plus or minus, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. It needs to be as efficient as we can.
These having points, I think, is helpful, and these proportions make sense to me. Mm-hmm. Especially the maintenance.
Yeah, finalizing the criteria until after you receive the proposals doesn't feel quite right process-wise.
Yeah. The criteria are the same.
Well, the weightings, right.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be generally, it's going to be up to these, but it may be shifted around, yeah. But, yeah, I understand. Yeah.
When's the goalposts on?
Well, you know, some agencies, you know, have policies where you list specific, you know, your numbers.
Right.
And that's what you submit. Well, that's what you include in your RFPs. And I've heard, I can't, not any specific, I've heard problems with that, you know, from actual...
Yeah. Right.
Practice of it, and people that are reviewing the proposals, and they've gotten something delivered that, you know, didn't meet their expectations because it had, you know, the points were, you know, assigned certain ways. And
So, question to you. I'm looking at the recommendation. The recommendation is to review and accept
yeah.
the proposed evaluation criteria. So I think the criteria are fine. It's the weighting that I'm not certain about, but you're not asking us to approve the weighting. In fact, you're saying that the weighting may be adjusted.
Yeah, it's more disapprove what I'm showing in the table, that you have this range, but here are the specific criteria.
Okay, so and yeah, thanks for clarifying.
Sure,
because
sure.
I'm comfortable with the criteria.
Okay, thank you.
Any comments? Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Does that do public comment?
Yeah, any other public comment? Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Primary sludge management evaluation with the Sausalito Marin City Sanitary District.
Yeah, over the last year, Sausalito's new manager, Jeff Hinkson, has asked a couple times at our monthly meetings where the managers get together to have treatment plans. He said, hey, Jason, can you guys receive our digested sludge? We can truck it to you. That way we don't have our transportation costs are less and take it to landfill, and you guys can use that. And I said, well, you guys have already digested it. You know, most of the energy content's removed from that sludge. I said, no, we want to receive your sludge, because then we have to have a handling facility to receive this thick material, you know. So then, you know, this conversation kind of more evolved to, well, how about our primary sludge? And the primary sludge is just the settled material from the primary clarifiers. It has a lot of energy content. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, that makes a lot more sense to me than the dewatered, you know, digested sludge, sure. And, you know, we've talked about this a few times in the past. We have a lot of capacity in the digesters. And so we had some initial discussions, you know, with Sausalito staff. They came here and they brought some sample analyses down on their biosolids. We compared it to, you know, what our permit requirements are, the requirements for some of our reuse sites, and there were no issues with the quality of it. And we have the capacity of the digesters, and we said, you know, it seems feasible to us. You guys, when you figure out, you know, how you could transport it here and how you'd get it from your primary clarifiers up to a truck. And so they've done that, and they're ready to maybe start a little pilot study where they start, you know, they put in the temporary system and they start trucking it here. So they actually wanted to start moving forward. And I said, well, you know, let me bring it to my board and just kind of present the idea to them, see what they think, and either they'll have some comments on it or maybe we'll get a green light to do some further evaluation. So we've looked at it in terms of, you know, the benefits to CMSA, and there's a lot of benefits. I mean, we have the capacity of the digester, so we could receive it. We have several places that it could be pumped into, you know, piping that lead to the digesters, so the infrastructure improvements would be minimal. We have the capacity. You would generate additional biogas, which is fuel in the engine, to produce more renewable power, which helps us achieve energy self-sufficiency and eventually selling more power. We'd receive a tipping fee, whatever that became. And also, we've talked about a few times in the past, you know, real briefly, that, you know, some of our wastewater process consultants have mentioned to us, as part of the master planning work, that there's this, you know, there's this theoretical limit on how much fat, oils, and grease you could send to a digester in ratio to wastewater solids. And our response was, well, you know, but we don't just send fat, oils, and grease. We send, you know, a slurry of food waste and fat, oils, and grease. So it's a different material, different composition, different, you know, chemical, you know, attributes. And they say, yeah, but you need to really think about what that limit is, because if there is a limit and you exceed it, then you could disrupt your digesters, and then you have to drain the digester and purge it and restart it. That disrupts all kinds of process and operations. It's very expensive. That's why we're doing the digester pilot study, is to figure out what that limit is. Mm-hmm.
Is that called indigestion?
That's what it is. That's what it is. So what we've learned is that if there is that limit, but if you increase the wastewater solids, great, then you could receive more organic waste. So this helps with that too, if there's a limit. So from a CMSA perspective, like management and staff, we think there's not an issue with it. It's a good thing for all those reasons. Now for Sausalito Marin City, they have a capital plan to retrofit digesters and invest in the new biosolids, you know, handling equipment. So this for them, if it made sense, they would avoid those capital costs to do that work. But they need to do more economic analysis. They need to know what's it going to cost in the trucking, you know, what are the improvements, you know, permanent improvements going to be to get the material, you know, to the trucks. CMSA, what are you going to charge us to do this? So they can figure out the economics. But if it worked out for them, then I think it would be beneficial for us. So this is just looking to get your authorization to do, you know, more thorough evaluation. And part of that would be looking at ranges of tipping fees, you know, which we, you know, review internally, then eventually bring to the board a recommendation of tipping fee if we, all the parties thought it was good to go forward. But it looks like it's, you know, conceptually it looks like it's a good benefit both agencies.
Anything that could go wrong? Sorry,
through the chair. That's okay.
From our perspective, if they had a lot of industrial facilities in Sausalito, they're manufacturing different things, and that those contaminants and toxic materials got into the sewer system, that could disrupt the digestion process, we'd be worried about that. But Sausalito is pretty much residential and just light commercial, you know, markets and restaurants and things. So we're not really concerned about that.
Every night is okay.
What's that?
Ship building. Ship repairing.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Ship. Doesn't ship.
Which is similar.
Yeah,
we do. Two questions. Number one, this is an internal evaluation. You're going to use your own staff.
Yeah, definitely.
And about how long is that going to take?
I don't know.
Is there any timeline that's been put out for this by?
No. You know, the level R evaluation, I think, would be pretty quick. If we focused effort on it, we could figure out, okay, this is where we need to connect up. This is what we need to do that they'll pay for to, you know, pump the material there. We're already looking at different ranges of tipping fees. So that's just an internal exercise, looking at our operational costs right now and, you know, kind of, you know, some cost of operations. So our work is, I think, is going to be pretty minimal in the evaluation because we've done enough to where we think that it's beneficial and makes sense. On their end, though, there's a lot more effort. And that's the timing. I'm not quite sure that. And I didn't ask Jeff either what the timing is. Right now, I mean, they, for the timing and the context, they have, you know, this major capital project where, you know, they're right over hanging over the bay. And they have major, you know, construction happening at their facility for the next, like, year and a half. So they have time to make this decision before they need to look at doing the digester rehab, which is the next major project in their plan. And really, it's been a while since we met with them and they went to go back and think about it. So I think they have a small staff, and I think right now they're really focused on their capital project, running their facilities while there's still this disruption, and it's getting everything built. And this is important to them, but it's not something that they need to get done in the next, you know, month or so.
So it's their timeline.
It's their timeline, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And your staff has the resources to do the work.
Yeah.
On their timeline.
Yeah, and we'll just work with them, you know, over time. So, if there's some developments, I'll let you guys know.
I enthusiastically support this project. I think it's consistent with our goals of consolidation and interagency efficiency. And my one question about it, though, if we went forward with it, if the parking lot is full of all the buses, can we have trucks coming in and out and buses parked there as well?
Yeah, we have a plant road that goes, it's a big loop around the plant.
Oh, okay.
And it diverts in two locations into the maintenance parking area and the corporation yard.
Well,
so, like right now, you know, we have a lot of trucks coming in for chemical deliveries, biosolids hauling, and they just go certain directions around the plant. You know, fog haulers. We have different arrows, different colors pointing different, you know, people in different directions.
Okay, yeah. So you can keep air traffic control.
Yeah. So they'd be like a brown arrow. You guys go this direction.
I agree, Jeff. This is everything we should be doing, which is sharing services and working with other agencies and consolidating. It's great. I think it's a win-win and win.
Just for my own curiosity, if something changed about the ranges being described here, where would your, if all of a sudden they say, oh, we want you to take on more than what this says, what would be the point at which capacity would be a problem?
Yeah. Well, they,
like you said, it says 5%.
Yes. So, you know, when we first started talking, they weren't quite sure how much primary sludge. So they've done a lot of work, and they're pretty confident it's 5,000. But say it's like, you know, 7,500. Say they're off by 50%, which could happen. You know, in terms of digest capacity, that's not much.
What if others start calling you somewhere?
Price is going to go up.
I mean, what's your pain threshold here with capacity?
You know, like our digester is only 55% loaded right now, and that's with everything we need for our facility and all the food waste that we are obligated to receive in our contract with Marin Sanitary. Then all the more discretionary organics that are coming in, we're only 55% loaded.
But are you
plus or minus?
You okay going up to 95%? I mean, what's your?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, Oh yeah. Load up those digesters. Piece out biogas. That's good stuff. 90%. It'd always be nice to have a spare digester sitting around. That's like $10 or $12 million.
Just trying to understand the gap.
Yeah.
You'll look at that when you're.
You'll let us know.
The key thing with the digesters is we need to maintain at least a 15-day residence time to meet, you know, EPA regulations for biosolids land disposal. So we could, when I say the processing, that's just, you know, hydraulically you could keep sending material to them, probably a lot more than we are now, or at the 100% level, then you're just pulling more out quicker for dewatering, so there's less time. So there's a hydraulic time capacity, the hydraulic limit, then there's a processing limit. Hydraulic limit is not really, doesn't need to be considered, it's the processing. And the processing, you have to have a minimum of 15 days in there to meet regulations. And right now we have, you know, we have like over 30 days in there.
Any other board comments? Anybody from the public? You, sir. Oh, wait. Hallucinating.
I'll move we authorize staff to evaluate CMSA receiving primary sludge from Sausalito Emergency Sanitary District and a feasible and viable for both agencies to prepare a draft service agreement.
Second.
Either way.
All in favor?
Aye.
Great. Thank
you. And item 12, informational items.
Just information for the board. If you have any questions, I can answer the questions.
There was no North Bay watershed due to the 4th of July.
About a question for the general manager? Oh, we couldn't have the general manager's report.
I have a couple little things to point out real quick.
Okay.
One is we have a employee appreciation barbecue next Wednesday. You're all welcome to come. We'll be barbecuing some good stuff and some potluck, and we just love it when board members show up and hang out with us.
What time?
It's noon. Okay. Then under projects, Amy talked about the secondary clarifier rehab project. So, and she's kind of leading up the design on that internally. And we'll be hiring a consultant to help with one part of it, and that's in this diagram here. So inside the clarifier, there's a big column. And inside that metal column, there's another column. So the water from the aeration tanks comes through the outer column, and it comes out this big rectangular opening into the clarifier. And all the sludge that settles in the clarifier is removed by piping that are on these big arms. And it's pumped up into a box in the top, and it goes through this inner pipe. So it's a pipe within a pipe. Well, when we had the clarifier down, we found this gigantic hole in the inner pipe. So that way some of that, you know, secondary sludge that's settled, that's supposed to go to thickening and digestion, it can intermingle with the aeration effluents that gets into the clarifier. So it's not a big process issue, but it needs to be fixed. So I'm just pointing this out to you that part of this, the scope that we'll have consultants have assistance with is figure out how to sequence the work to remove certain things and replace, you know, this piping system between the floor of the digesters and the platform. So I just wanted to show you kind of so visually you can see the big hole in the pipe within the pipe.
Is that corrosion?
Yeah, it's really just, you know, corrosion and a little bit of abrasion just over the decades. And we, you know, I asked our staff, and they said that the other three clarifiers have holes also, but they're not as big as this hole here. So as Amy mentioned during her presentation, design will be wrapped up this year. We'll have the consultant help out with the pipe, you know, repair methodology. And then we'll do one clarifier a year because we only have one down for major maintenance because we need three operational. So that's why we space out over 40 time period. That's all I had. Oh, yeah. The cogen engine. Yes. You know what? And I forgot to type that up on here before I printed this out and put the nice photo on the back. I didn't want to waste all that paper. So, the refurbished engine. So what's happened since the last meeting? So we worked with Bill McNerney to prepare a purchase order with terms and conditions for the procurement of the Kraft Power Industries used refurbished, you know, Waukesha Cogen engine, same model. So that was all done. And that kind of happened while I was on my vacation. But I sent Kraft an email right after a board meeting saying, please let this, you know, serve as the agency's commitment to, you know, we've selected an alternative. Our board's approved, you know, purchasing your engine. Please let this be an agreement to go ahead and proceed with the work. So they accepted that. So they took the engine, shipped it to their repair facility. It was fully dismantled. It was inspected. There was some machining work that had to be done, internally, some pitting and stuff. There were some tolerances that had to be adjusted, a few parts that had to be replaced. I don't have the details on that. But that work's been completed. Now, the whole, you know, kind of core of the engine, as the crankshaft was beautiful, is that the whole core was shipped back, is in process of being shipped back to their facility in Ohio. It should arrive this Friday. Then they'll spend the next week to week and a half reassembling the engine with all the upper end components. Then they'll start it up, make sure it runs properly, and then they're going to ship it to CMSA. So we're going to send our assistant maintenance supervisor, Kevin, you know, Lewis, who knows a lot about Waukesha engines, out to the facility just to observe the last day or two of the assembly and the startup to witness that.
And where are they again?
Ohio. And then we're going to hire a rigging company that's going to take out the current engine and accessories that are damaged for disposal. And then all the parts of the current engine that are good, those are going to go in storage for future, you know, preventive maintenance work. And then the engine will be delivered to the same rigging company. Then we'll take it off that truck and we'll install it in this location. And then we're getting proposals right now from Valley Power and Peterson Cat to assist in installing the new engine after it's placed, connecting it up, starting it up, and getting the emissions, you know, dialed into our air permit requirements.
So how long do they run it before they release it?
I don't have an answer to that. I'm sure it's for a decent amount of time. Turn it up, turn it off quick before something happens, you know.
It's more than the proverbial
around
the block
for
the motorcycle.
I could ask and send you an email to tell you that they answered that. I just don't know.
What's our best guess of date of operation?
Our best guess would be that you know, probably a month, I would say, within the month, probably close to the end of the month.
So
one month from today.
So in August. Early August.
That's what we're hoping, yeah. Okay. And once, you know, once what I'll do is I can send you kind of informational little update emails. You know, once you know it's shipped to CMSA and I get a report from Kevin, then once it's delivered, I can let you know. Since we don't have an August board meeting, so I can kind of touch base and let you know what's happening. If there's delays for some reason, I can let you know. That way you're not surprised in September when we get together.
And if in those emails you could also include the increased cost of purchasing electricity that we've incurred, that would be...
Yeah, you know, just on that topic, just for a partial, you know, the billing period is not on a month. It's like, you know, from middle of a month to another middle of a month. So for that period where we're fully, you know, generating power, even one day of exporting, and then we had a half a month of it being down, that bill was, I think it was like $54,000.
Oh.
So on that one half of the month where we were, you know, generating power, MC, you know, procurement costs were tiny, but we still have huge transportation and delivery costs from PG&E. Mm-hmm. But so it's 54. We estimated that a full entire month would be, you know, upwards of $80,000 during the peak demand period season.
Yeah.
Okay.
Last
question. It's good. It's moving so quickly.
May. What are these outfall diffusers being buried by? Is it just sediment that's in the bay water that just settles on top of them?
Yeah, it's just essentially, you know, the sediment in the bay floor shifts. So each year the diver goes out and they'll measure the distance between. So there's 176 of these diffusers in a row, 6 feet on center. And originally they were all the same height, 5 feet. And over time, the bay floor, it changes. Mm-hmm. And so sediments will build up, you know, for some years, and they'll drop down. So when they build up, we have a criteria that when the floor gets within, I forget what it is, maybe a foot of the flange where this valve, this duckbill check valve attaches, then we raise it 2 feet. So right now, if you looked at a profile of that outfall diffuser section, you might have some at the front end that are 5 feet still. Then you have some might be 14 or 15 feet, and the bay mud is shifted high. Now, at the outer end of the outfall, one year there was just, you know, I mean, there were low, I guess it was through some drought years, not much river flow coming through, so there's a lot of deposition that just stayed there, and things get shifted around by large flows. And so the last 24 diffusers are just buried. and they're buried where the divers can't even find them. Well, we were worried about that for a bunch of years. But we've done, and we shared this with the board during the master planning work when we looked at gravity flow versus pumped flow limitations, current versus sea level rise with in 50 years with a 100-year storm event. So you probably don't remember that graph, but pretty much those with pumped flow, it doesn't matter if half the diffusers are buried, because we'll just have the horsepower to pump the water out. Under gravity flow, it's still okay, which was surprising. But Corollo did that for us as part of the master plan. They used these complex hydraulic evaluation software where they modeled our outfall there with different diffusers that were on and off and different bay elevations, giving sea level rise projections based on the Eastern Marin Vulnerability Assessment that was done by the county.
Eventually, we're going to do something with those 24 buried diffusers. You can't just abandon them in the bay.
Yeah, but I heard Amy say that they needed a human being to go out there.
Let's do it. Give me some flippers.
There's 24. You can find them.
Give me some flippers and a shovel.
The secretary called
for us. They're 6 feet. I mean, if you're one.
The secretary, we could add that to this. And take notes.
Right. Picture.
There's no meeting next month, right? There's no meeting next month. September. Let me know when we're on commissioner comments or whatever.
Let's do commissioner comments.
But you have your watershed report first.
You said there was
one.
Yeah, there wasn't one.
No, okay. I have a question / favorite ask. I would like to save your staff the trouble of driving on Friday afternoons to deliver my staff report in the house. So, I normally look at the reports online.
Oh, okay.
Before. Mm-hmm. If I could just have a hard copy here.
Sure.
So I don't have to scroll through the whole report to get to the items. That would help a lot. But that would save your, I'm sure, frustration trying to.
Yeah, we can update our agenda distribution list.
Mm-hmm. I'll do that. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll have it here waiting for you and not either hand deliver or mail.
I promise. Sure.
There are tabs on the PDF too. So if you look at the tabs, there each item is a tab. So you don't have to scroll through all of it.
I was doing my best to get through.
Okay, thank you.
My main concern is to save your staff.
Why are they driving around?
Because we haven't told them not to.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Kate calls me and I come pick up. That's only my office is across the highway.
So normally we target to have the agenda published by Thursday afternoon, then we put it in the mail.
Yes.
But because of the holiday, we lost that day to get it done, so we had to target to get it done on Friday, and we're fearful that if we put it in the mail, it wouldn't get delivered in time. So then our procedures, then we go hand deliver it.
Well, just that time of day, it's unreasonable to ask anybody to leave it.
Yeah, and we're so far flung, too.
Well, we have two staff members that do it, so
it's like a lot of staff time. Should this ever arise again that you feel the need to hand deliver something, I think you should check with the commissioner to make sure that they need a hard copy, and that they couldn't make do with the.
Well, they couldn't come by themselves and pick it up.
And pick it up, or use the electronic version and just have a hard copy pick up.
Who besides me gets it hand delivered?
Only when they hand deliver it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Most of the time it's in the mail.
Most of the time it's in the mail.
I just want to.
What we're going to do is, if we can't get in the mail on Thursday, we'll do is we can send out a note on Wednesday or Thursday. When we know we're not going to get it out, we can say, we could either drop it off, or you can come pick it up, or you can look online. Just let us know your preference. We can send a note out.
Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. I don't hear back from you. It's online.
Yeah. We're going to put that in the minutes.
I didn't really think about that.
Good job.
Good
job.
Well done.
What is that?
Keeper. No, no. And when you want to know,
General Manager.
There's a lady there.
San Rafael.
Thorn Tree Safari.
Thorn Tree Safari.